Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, April 20th, 2015. There's a refugee crisis on the Mediterranean Sea. Hundreds have died. This bouncy little song by Genesis belies the tragic events of the past few days, building on weeks of waves of immigrants approaching the shores of Italy and other Mediterranean ports on the European side. And just about all of the refugees originate from Africa, some from Libya in North Africa, others from deeper in the continent, where, of course, we know that there is a great deal of violence and unrest. So there are three or more separate events. The most deadly was the sinking of a ship on Saturday night off the coast of Libya, where at least 700 people are presumed dead. There were as many as 950 thought to be aboard this boat, and only 24 bodies had been recovered by Sunday evening. Now, there are other events as well. The Italians and the Maltese were responding to distress calls from two other crafts, an inflatable raft with somewhere around 150 people on board near the coast of Libya, and a separate vessel holding 300 people. In yet another event, off the Greek island of Rhodes, a ship that had some 80 migrants on board, a sailing vessel, hit the rocks, and a man, a woman, and a child were killed. So this is a pattern that is developing. It's not isolated to Libya, but the destabilization, the overthrow of the Gaddafi government there, has led to a failed state, which is just being run by various militia groups, and it's probably a pretty unsafe place to live. But one of the real troubling patterns that we see here is this increase in migration. In 2013, the estimate was about 100,000 people tried to enter the European Union illegally. That was up from 75,000 the year before. And this year alone, the number of would-be migrants arriving on Greek shores from Turkey alone has tripled compared to the past year. And what is really tragic is that at least on the largest ship that capsized, it appears that it was a result of a scramble by the passengers. And we've seen this happen before in Asia on these huge ferries that carry people between, say, the Philippine Islands or the Malaysian Islands. And the ugly people, the mercenaries, if you will, who are running these human trafficking operations, reportedly warned people not to move once they got on the ship. But the report is on Saturday, there was a scramble as people saw another ship on the horizon, and they apparently all moved to one side of the ship, causing it to capsize. So these are deep tragedies, and compounded by racial and ethnic tensions, because on one of these boats last week, Italian police have charged 15 Muslim men with homicide after they were accused of tossing 12 Christians off of their refugee boat. So this is a deep set of issues, and I do believe that in this case it's a humanitarian problem, and it would be appropriate for the U.S. to respond. We don't necessarily have to send armed troops or predator drones, but there are things we could do to ease the plight of the refugees and help European countries deal with it. And I hope we will. Well, my BS detector is activated. I just want to report this to you. We have another case of the FBI accusing six Somali Americans, mostly from the area near Minneapolis, of attempting to travel to the Middle East to join the Islamic State, the forces also called Daesh. All six are Somali Americans aged 19 to 21. And as you know, I'm very skeptical of these theatrically staged busts by our government. We know that there's been a heavy effort to infiltrate one or more of the mosques in the Minneapolis area. And I note this, let's see, I'm going to count it for you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. In the 10th paragraph of a 13 or 14 paragraph story in the New York Times, here is the troubling sentence. In a pattern seen in other cases as well, two of the men suddenly obtained about $1,500 in cash that they used to buy airline tickets. A central question is there in their case is where they got the money. Well, let me just offer an idle guess. How about their paid FBI informant? That's the pattern we've seen in so many other cases. And if that surfaces here, I will not be surprised. Now, speaking of ISIL, ISIS, IS, Daesh, Der Spiegel published a lengthy article over the weekend, and I read it all the way through. And it is a fascinating expose based on documents that Der Spiegel recovered from the Syrian town of Aleppo. And what it details is that a former intelligence colonel in the Iraqi military during the Saddam era is the true architect of the Islamic State's expansion into Syria. And this guy got the full treatment. He was in the military when the U.S. invaded. He was stripped of his position when we debathified or debathification. We fired all of Saddam's people from the Iraqi military and installed Shiites mostly loyal to Iran. Brilliant, eh? Then this guy spent time in Abu Ghraib and other American-run prisons during the occupation. But Der Spiegel has gained access to 31 pages of handwritten charts, lists, and schedules that amount to a blueprint for the establishment of their presence in Syria. And what's most notable is that it's not based on religious values or the expansion of a caliphate. No. It's based on military expansionism and control. Der Spiegel said the file suggests the takeover of northern Syria was part of a meticulous plan overseen by the man named Klifawi. He used the nom de guerre Haji Bakr. But he used techniques that he had learned under Saddam. Surveillance, espionage, murder, kidnapping. And when Daesh, the Islamic State, started to move into a town, they collected intelligence on all the people there. And that's how they developed their leverage and how they could manipulate and threaten people into submitting to their control. So in 2010, Klifawi and a small group of former Iraqi intelligence officers made the decision to make Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi the official leader of ISIL, with the goal of giving the group a, quote, religious face. But in this account from Al Jazeera, Iraqi journalist Hisham al-Hashimi, whose cousin was in ISIL with Klifawi, described the former officer as a nationalist rather than someone whose main motivation was religious. And I believe this to be true. I think that this whole caliphate talk and the window dressing of radical Islam is bullshit. And I think it is simply a convenient facade, or as we say in software, a skin on the front of what is otherwise pretty clearly a calculated military operation. Well, you'll be excited to know that we're number one. And the Daesh and these endless wars in the Middle East will probably keep us that way. We're number one in exporting arms, fighter jets, and other war materiel to this conflict region. And there is more on the way. The New York Times, in a somewhat celebratory story published on Saturday, said that Saudi Arabia is using F-15 fighter jets from Boeing. In the UAE, they're flying Lockheed Martin's F-16 to bomb Yemen and Syria. Soon, The United Arab Emirates are expected to complete a deal with General Atomics for a fleet of their own Predator drones. And, of course, all of this fattens the bottom line of the war profiteers that we call defense contractors in this country. And while we did have some restraints on arms sales to Middle East nations other than Israel, many of those are not a problem right now because Israel is happy to see the Arabs arm up and clear their military inventories in a confrontation with Iran, this proxy war that's underway in Yemen right now. The Saudis spent more than $80 billion on weaponry last year, and the Emirates spent $23 billion. Qatar is on a shopping spree. They signed an $11 billion deal with the Pentagon to purchase Apache attack helicopters and Patriot and Javelin air defense systems. Get a warranty for that shit, guys. Now the tiny nation is hoping to make a large purchase of Boeing's F-15 fighters. Boeing opened an office in Doha in 2011. Lockheed Martin set up an office there last year. And this could lead to reviving the fortunes of the F-35 fighter jet, which is a huge boondoggle, costing us, you know, millions and billions per unit. And this article suggests that because Iran last week announced its intention to sell an advanced air defense system to, Russia announced its plan to sell an advanced air defense system to Iran, that this could increase demand for the F-35, the white elephant in the American hardware lineup right now. So there is no end in sight. This is endless war. It is endless war profiteering. And I make direct linkage between that profiteering and these political, theatrical arrests of so-called Americans who want to go fight for the Islamic State. I think that is simply the exportation of fear to keep Americans from thinking too hard about what's really going on. And it says here, the deal to sell Predator drones to the Emirates is nearing final approval. These will be unarmed reconnaissance drones. At least that's what we're being told. And speaking of drones, on Friday, Jeremy Scahill published a lengthy piece in The Intercept about our drone program. And I invite you to read it. I'll link to it so that you can read it at your convenience. But there are a number of important issues that are raised here. And this is based apparently on leaks that didn't come from Ed Snowden. It refers to a top-secret U.S. intelligence document obtained by The Intercept, and it shows that our military base in Germany at Ramstein is not a place where drones are directly controlled from, but it is a critical relay station. And you know, for example, that Creech Air Force Base near Las Vegas, there's one in upstate New York, there's one in Georgia. These are the locations of the remote control pilots who operate the drones from the secure comfort safety of an American military base. But their signals are sent by a fiber optic cable under the Atlantic, and in Germany is where those signals go skyward via satellite devices and control systems. And this is a dicey issue for the relationship between the U.S. and Germany, and it's something that we dance around. There are members of the German parliament who have demanded that Chancellor Angela Merkel confront the United States about this, and they've been told to sit down and shut up. And it's fascinating because when the president went to Berlin in 2013, he made a denial of an accusation that had never been made. All right? His statement was, "We do not use Germany as a launching point for unmanned drones as part of our counterterrorism activities." Well, no one has ever said that. The drones that fly over Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, They're not launched from Rammstein. It is a control relay point. And so with that non-denial denial, the U.S. maintains what Scahill refers to as a don't ask, don't tell understanding. But there are lawsuits pending over the civilians killed by drones that could reveal much more than Germany would care for us to know about. And speaking of drones, an interesting column from my old pal John Carroll. He writes 4 days a week in the San Francisco Chronicle about anything he wants to write about. A lot of times it's about cats, it's about exploring trails around the Bay Area. He's a guy with many different interests. But last week, on Friday, he published a column entitled, It's Secret, Must Not Ask, Because It's Secret, Okay? Now, I don't agree with this opening statement that I'm quoting here. He says, I don't buy the demonization of drones. They're just another means of delivering death. But I agree with much of the rest of what I'm quoting here. Still, drones are the current weapon of choice. A report this week by the Open Society Justice Initiative said that drones are killing a lot more civilians in Yemen and Pakistan than has been acknowledged. The president has assured us several times that the strikes are surgical and that there must be near certainty that civilians will not be harmed. But we have dead civilians. When asked about the report, National Security Council spokesman said, in those rare instances in which it appears that noncombatants may have been killed or injured, after-action reviews have been conducted. And Carroll follows up with this retort, can you count the number of wiggle words in that sentence? They don't even admit that they're not admitting anything. Some drone strikes are not revealed even after they happen. Carroll continues, information on the number of people killed is classified. So are the data on noncombatant deaths. Obama apparently pushed back early on some of the more elaborate scenarios, but he eventually bought into most of the premises of drone warfare. Because it's all secret, we have no idea how effective drone strikes are. Because it's secret, no one can talk about it. And it's secret because they say so. It's like breaches in Homeland Security. We are told that there have been many such attempted breaches, and the government has rebuffed almost all of them. No bombs in your bank buildings, but there's still danger. Give us money. Interesting comments from John Carroll of the San Francisco Chronicle. Every day I like to express my gratitude to the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Glenn Richards just took out a new annual subscription the other day. Thank you, Glenn, and welcome aboard. Sandra Williams just renewed her annual subscription. Judy Holloway is a regular monthly subscriber. And Craig Balog continues to kick in $20 a month. That's four times more than he has to, and I really appreciate that. I invite you to join them. Maybe you just got your tax refund check and you got a little extra cash. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a link right under my mugshot on the homepage that says sign up. It takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our best deal, that $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the continental U.S. or anywhere in the world get a bonus gift from me, an ebook copy of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Israel's foreign minister, the hard right-liner, Avigdor Lieberman, went ballistic the other day, and it appears it took him only seconds to play the anti-Semitism card. But the European Union is demanding that Israel properly label products that are made in the West Bank, because they're not made in Israel. But that's how the labeling currently appears. And, of course, there are many ramifications of this. It relates to the desire by some people from Europe not to buy products that were produced under the occupation, not to support Israel economically in that manner. There are also political motives in driving this issue at this point. But Lieberman told Israel Radio, they can take a yellow badge and mark all the products from Judea and Samaria and the Golan Heights with a yellow badge. Now, I believe that's referring to the Holocaust and the way Germany forced Jews to wear a Star of David, often in yellow, on their clothing. And it's just more hate speech from a guy like Lieberman, who is unwilling to recognize the implications of the extreme tactics used by his government. In Iran, Jason Rezaian, the U.S. reporter who's been held since last July 14th, has, they've explained more of the charges against him. He's been charged with espionage and three other major crimes. The Post says his lawyer reports that he's also facing the charge of collaborating with hostile governments and propaganda against the establishment. The indictment alleges he'd been collecting classified information, especially about internal and foreign policy, providing them to individuals with hostile intent, including Barack Obama. Now, is that because they presume that Barack Obama reads the Washington Post, or that Jason Rezaian is some sort of a secret agent who was feeding information to the White House? Well, the Post is getting more forceful in its defense of Rezaian. They said the charges are absurd, baseless, and manufactured. Martin Baron, executive editor, quote, "The grave charges against Jason that Iran has now disclosed could not be more ludicrous. It is absurd and despicable to assert, as Iran's judiciary is now claiming, that Jason's work amounted to espionage or otherwise posed any threat to Iranian national security." Now, it also emerged today that the family of Jason Rezaian are filing complaints against a number of Iranian media organizations for their increasingly hostile campaign against him. Unattributed accusations printed in the Iranian press have alleged that Rezaian worked undercover as a spy. The FARS official news agency alleged that Rezaian had provided economic and industrial data to the U.S. government. So it's getting a little thicker there, but at least it appears they're going to bring him to trial in the near future, and maybe we will see some resolution. Speaking of Iran, on Friday, President Obama met with the Prime Minister of Italy, Matteo Renzi, and in the news conference that followed, Obama signaled greater flexibility to his negotiators, John Kerry and Secretary of Energy Moniz, as the talks resume with Iran over its alleged nuclear programs. So the president said that he is ordering his diplomats to use creative negotiations to bridge the gap regarding lifting the sanctions. And he didn't repeat past American assertions that this would occur in phases. And that, we know, is what the Ayatollah and the prime minister of Iran, Rouhani, have been publicly agitating for in the last couple of weeks. And the lead negotiator, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif of Iran, broke his silence and said, well, you know, the U.S., for their own domestic reasons, produced a fact sheet, which was not exactly what we adopted. But he was diplomatic. He said, it's, our right and prerogative to do that. But the Iranians are getting increasingly aggressive in negotiating in public, and I just see this as a very, very tough road to complete these negotiations by the end of June and come up with a positive outcome. Well, there is a new book due out the first week of May called Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Governments and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich. Now, this is going to be a book that's going to become a political football. I can already see the Daily Kos types and some of my Facebook friends who are in deep with Hillary. And they'll just respond viscerally and emotionally and deny it all. And they'll be able to say that the author of this book, Peter Schweitzer, is from a right-wing think tank at Stanford, the Hoover Institution. He's published articles before on the Breitbart website. And he was a speechwriter for George W. Bush. And I'm certain that those attacks on Peter Schweitzer are already being loaded into the systems of the David Brock Hillary Defense Committee. And we're also seeing salvos already coming from people who want to be Clinton's opponent. In November of 2016, that would be the Republican candidates. But the allegations are very serious. The Clintons' income After they left the White House and through 2012, when Hillary stepped down as Secretary of State, was at least $136 million. And Schweitzer argues that a free trade agreement in Colombia benefited a major Clinton Foundation donor's natural resource investments in the South American nation, that development projects in the aftermath of the Haitian earthquake in 2010, and the more than $1 million in payments to Bill Clinton by a Canadian bank and a major shareholder in the Keystone XL pipeline project occurred about the time that it was being debated in Hillary's State Department. And I think these questions need to be aired out and answered, because there were issues raised in 2009 when Hillary was named Secretary of State, and Bill Clinton's income from speaking fees to foreign nations and from the Clinton Foundation's global campaigns, those could have conflicted with Hillary's job as Secretary of State. And there are at least some appearances here that it did. And we learned that in 2011 alone, Bill Clinton made $13 million in speaking fees for 54 speeches, the majority of which were made overseas. And I haven't read the book, but the New York Times writer says, he writes mainly in the voice, this is Schweitzer, he writes mainly in the voice of a neutral journalist and meticulously documents his sources, including tax records and government documents, while leaving little doubt of his view of the Clintons. Be prepared. Shitstorm straight ahead. And speaking of that kind of a storm, I don't do a lot of reporting based on the calendar. You know, today is such and such a day. But 5 years ago this morning, we woke up to learn of the expanding disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. The Deepwater Horizon problem platform tapping into the Macondo well blew. Millions of gallons of oil poured into the Gulf of Mexico, followed by millions of gallons of ugly chemical toxic dispersants that were used in the area. The damage is still quite severe. I'm going to link to a package at Vice News, and you can see the tar balls that keep blowing or floating up along the shoreline of the Gulf. And you can see a report about Cat Island. Before the disaster, it was a 2-acre bird habitat anchored by dense black mangroves in Louisiana's Barataria Bay. All that's left today is a sandbar surrounded by mangrove stumps. Now, I don't know if this was caused by the oil or the dispersants or a combination of the two. But when you see the aerial photographs of Cat Island the way it was and what remains today, it is a very graphic and sinister depiction of the remnants of the spill that occurred 5 years ago. And considering that the Obama administration continues to issue offshore drilling leases, including in the Arctic, along the East Coast, we've learned precious little from this massive, massive problem. And last week, the Interior Department announced a new regulation on blowout preventers. And that's just a little tiny step forward. But we shouldn't be drilling there to begin with. And considering the impact on the Gulf and the impact on the climate, we shouldn't be writing leases for any of these offshore sites. But hey, they're not listening to me. Well, today is the the rescheduled date for the actual Boston Marathon. They pushed it back a week from the events of 2 years ago. And later this week, the jury that convicted Johar Tsarnaev on all of the counts that he was accused of, will reconvene to consider whether he gets life without parole or the death penalty. And two voices, victims' voices, have been heard vehemently suggesting that the government should not seek the death penalty. And the voices come from Bill and Denise Richard. Their 8-year-old son, Martin, was with his family at the finish line when the bombs exploded. And young Martin was killed. He was the youngest victim of the events of April 15th. But the Richard family has said, after this trial where Bill Richard testified, that they've had enough. In an open letter to the Justice Department, the Richards praised law enforcement and the Justice Department for their management of the case. But they said, "We would be in favor of and would support the Department of Justice in taking the death penalty off the table in exchange for the defendant spending the rest of his life in prison without any possibility of release and waiving all of his rights to appeal." Well, I think that's remarkable. Because in a nation where vengeance is seen as kind of, you know, a part of your constitutional rights, I think it's really touching that these individuals, parents, can put aside their own great loss and suffering and acknowledge that the death penalty is wrong and that state-sponsored killing is no better than the wanton killing that occurred at the Boston Marathon. And as you know, I still have so many questions about that case, the way the government handled it, the leads that were not followed, the threads that were not exposed. And after the jury makes its decision, we will set up a podcast interview with Russ Baker and one or more of his reporters at whowhatwhy.com. They've done an excellent job covering this case and honestly expressing the contradictions in the government story. And we will bring that to you as soon as there is a final verdict in the penalty phase. And as we wrap up the podcast today, it's 4:20 all day long here on April 20th.
Me up and smoke me when I die.
We turn to Willie Nelson's news of the day. Willie is, and the term used here is, rolling out materials that can be rolled up. Willie Nelson is jumping into the movement to commercialize marijuana and plans to roll out his own brand of cannabis that he intends to make the best on the market.
Call my friends and tell them there's a party, come on by. Now just roll me up and smoke me when I die.
The singer-songwriter announced in a statement that Willie's Reserve will be grown and sold in Colorado and Washington, two states where recreational use is legal. The release explained Willie's Reserve reflects Nelson's appreciation for the many varieties and range of the plant's qualities. And the 81-year-old Willie Nelson will collaborate with master growers to define standards for the strain. Happy 420, Willie Nelson. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
While I've been here long enough, so sing and tell more jokes and dance and stuff. Just keep the music playing, that'll be a good goodbye. Roll me up and smoke me when I die.
Roll me up and smoke me when I die. And if anyone don't like it, just look them in the eye. I didn't come here and I ain't leaving, so don't sit around and cry. Just roll me up and smoke me when I die.